order.
You've got time now.
Come right back and sit down.
We will open today's meeting with a public hearing on House Bill 2133. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. House Bill 2133 relates to petition for appeal of Circuit Court's denial of post-conviction relief if the lateness is not the fault of the petitioner. Under present Oregon law allows any person convicted of a crime and who has exhausted appeal rights to seek post-conviction relief, or PCR. In short, a petitioner is entitled to PCR if the petitioner demonstrates that, one, there was a substantial denial of the petitioner's constitutional rights, two, the sentencing court lacked jurisdiction, three, the sentence was improper, or four, the statute on which the conviction was based is unconstitutional. A petitioner has 2 years from the date of the judgment or from the final Oregon appeal, whichever is later, to file the original petition for PCR, and that original petition is filed in the circuit court. Potential remedies for PCR include, but are not limited to, release, a new trial, or sentence modification. Once a circuit court receives a petition for PCR, it then conducts a hearing into the matter. If the circuit court denies the petitioner then has 30 days to file an appeal with the Oregon Court of Appeals. House Bill 2133 addresses this 30-day time period. A petitioner gets an additional 60 days to file if the petitioner shows that the lateness of the filing is not attributable to the petitioner and that there was a, quote, colorable claim of error, close quote, in the proceeding from which the appeal is taken. In addition, House Bill 2133 addresses a court's ability to release a petitioner with a pending PCR appeal.
Okay, we have the Kumbaya panel here, Tim Sylvester and Ann Christian.
And this time, Madam Chair, I think it's what?
As opposed to?
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice. I'm submitting some written testimony here. I think that there should probably be no controversy about these provisions. What this bill does is make three small changes in the Post-Conviction Hearing Act, both to clarify some parts of the act that right now are a bit unclear and create unnecessary litigation, and also to allow the process to work a little bit more efficiently. As committee counsel described, the primary purpose of this is to allow for a late filing of a notice of appeal in a post-conviction proceeding similar to the, or actually identical to the process that currently is allowed for a defendant who is appealing from a conviction. And the reason why this is important is that oftentimes the counsel who represent petitioners in post-conviction proceedings are court-appointed, and they're paid by the state, and if there is a default by the counsel in filing a timely notice of appeal, that deprives a defendant who may not personally be at fault with a right of appeal, which is a bit unfair and also creates unnecessary litigation in the appellate process regarding whether somebody should be allowed to pursue an appeal, notwithstanding that they file their notice of appeal in an untimely way. And so this statute will simply streamline the process, allow for a late filing of a notice of appeal, and correct that little bit of injustice in the process. The other parts of 2133 that merit discussion are one provision provides that makes clear right now the law is a bit unclear as to when the state appeals from an adverse post-conviction judgment, whether that automatically stays the effectiveness of the post-conviction court's judgment during the appeal. We have always argued that it does. We don't have a court decision on that, and it creates a bit of uncertainty in the law. And so what this will do is we'll fix that uncertainty by providing that it does automatically stay the effectiveness of the judgment, but at the same time gives the post-conviction court the authority to allow the petitioner to be released pending appeal if it's otherwise appropriate to do so. And then the third part of the bill is simply to require that in those few instances in which a post-conviction petitioner actually does obtain relief, the post-conviction court grants post-conviction relief, that the burden is on the post-conviction petitioner to ensure that a copy of that judgment be served on the original trial court and on the district attorney. And the reason that is important is that post-conviction actions generally are prosecuted in a county other than the county in which the underlying conviction was entered, and the Department of Justice, rather than the district attorney, represents the state in those proceedings. And so it's necessary to get the post-conviction judgment filed back in the original county of in which the conviction was entered, so that further proceedings can be had on that judgment. And so what this simply requires is that the petitioner's attorney is the one who bears the burden of doing that, and that it's a modest burden, and it will make the process more efficient. Unless the committee has questions, that's all I have at this point.
Well, when you say if the petitioner is not personally, if the error isn't, if failure to file is not attributed to the petitioner personally, under what circumstance would a petitioner be denied this relief? What would be regarded as a personal reason?
Well, for example, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the petitioners in post-conviction proceedings rely on their counsel to file the notice of appeal or something of that nature. And so if the default in filing a notice of appeal is the fault of counsel and the petitioner himself did not have any responsibility for that default, then this would be a situation you could get a relief on a delayed appeal. There are some circumstances, however, when the petitioner himself may be personally responsible. For example, if it is a situation where the petitioner was representing himself in the post-conviction proceeding and he lost and then he failed to file a timely notice of appeal. Or if he was represented by counsel, but then when they got an adverse judgment, he said, well, I don't want to appeal it. And so counsel doesn't file a notice of appeal, but then the petitioner changes his mind. And so there are a variety of circumstances in which a petitioner may be personally at fault for the default in filing a notice of appeal. And one thing I did want to say, add to my testimony, is that we do currently have a couple of cases in the post-conviction, in the Court of Appeals right now, in which a petitioner failed to file a timely notice of appeal and is trying to get some sort of relief from the Court of Appeals. And it is our intent that this bill, when and if it is enacted, will apply to all current appeals in the Court of Appeals, and my understanding from looking at the law is that is what the effect of this bill would have. It will apply to currently pending motions for relief, and anyway, that's our intent, and I think that's what they would prefer too.
Okay, before we move on, Senator Beyer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions, I guess. First, I'll deal with the last thing you testified to, the fact that the petitioner now going to have to serve notice to the county court and the DA. Mm-hmm. That's what you said, right?
Yes.
So we're going to have the same defense attorney that couldn't file a timely process now has to file a notice with the circuit court and the DA?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, no, Section 3, those are two different provisions. Section 1 is the one that deals with the filing of an untimely notice of appeal. Section 2, which was the third thing I was talking about, is in those situations in which the petitioner actually goes through the proceeding and prevails and wins and gets post-conviction relief. And in those circumstances, the question is, the judgment, the post-conviction judgment needs to go, generally orders the case to be remanded back to the original trial court mm-hmm. for further proceedings. And in those situations where the petitioner's attorney actually has been successful and has obtained relief, we're saying you need to make sure that the district attorney and the original trial court get served with that judgment before the original trial court and the district attorney then have an obligation to proceed on the judgment. And so those are two separate things.
But yes, but they're two separate things. But you're saying in the first section of the bill that the attorney can't get a timely notice done, but if he does, then you're gonna, or if he doesn't do that, you give him this extra time. Then if he wins, you're going to expect that same person that couldn't get timely notice done to send the order back to the circuit court. And the sarcasm doesn't require a response. Because the first section of the bill, as I told the chair before the committee, you're talking about people have nothing on their time, on their hands but time, and they can't get a 30-day notice required. I think it's kind of crazy.
Why don't we hear from Ms. Krishy?
Thank you.
You're about to jump out of your seat, and then we can see if some of those are answered.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian, and I am the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. And if I could first answer or attempt to answer Senator Byer's question, Section 1 of the bill addresses an appeal. So if I'm an inmate and I wish to challenge the validity of my conviction by post-conviction relief, I first would request the court appoint counsel, to represent me at the trial level, so in a circuit court in the state of Oregon. And that's what Section 2 addresses. So my attorney at the trial level, if we're successful, would be required to file the judgment with the original district attorney and the court. In that instance, we don't have a situation, at least that I'm aware of, based on when I worked for the state a number of years ago, where there's going to be an issue with counsel who's been successful in the trial level post-conviction relief getting that judgment filed with the court. The original bill did have an additional requirement on trial level counsel, and quite frankly, we raised concerns about that trial level provision as far as trial counsel having to file a petition that could adversely impact if counsel messed up and didn't do it timely. At least that's the way we read the bill. And it has been my experience throughout the session. The Department of Justice was willing to talk, and in fact, that was amended out. Section 1 deals with an appeal. And it seems like, Senator Byer, when you said you have an individual who has nothing else to do, with time on their hands for 30 days, maybe the inmate is one that one could refer to that way. The defense attorney who's appointed to represent that inmate on appeal is not usually the same attorney who handled the trial level matter. And in fact, it can occur, and I know it has occurred, not recently, but occurred in the past, where a court, simply because they're so busy, doesn't even get the notice to the new appellate attorney that there's an appeal, notice of appeal that needs to be filed and this attorney's been appointed until after 30 days. So I think it's a situation that's maybe not as clear as one would think, where counsel on appeal may not even get notice from the court until 20-some days into that 30 days. So it's a safeguard, I think, not just for the inmate and the attorney, but for Department of Justice and the entire system, because these cases, when a deadline is missed, similarly to a criminal appeal, when a deadline is missed, it's not efficient for the entire system to have these occurring. So briefly, I would say that Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers appreciates Department of Justice bringing this bill forward, especially in light of the fact that every once in a while, and it is rare, but every once in a while that there is an attorney who misses the deadline, and we believe the inmate, the person who's been, who is seeking post-conviction relief, ought not to suffer. And I'm not an expert on this, Mr. Sylvester is, but I'm concerned that in these instances where a deadline is missed, it might only make things more complicated, if you will, for the Department of Justice in particular, when these cases ultimately go to the federal courts.
Okay. Is there any chance that the effect of this will be to just change the deadline from 30 to 90 days?
Chair Burdick, I don't think so. We've had this same statutory scheme working on the criminal side for a long time, and very, very few people obtain relief under that. I anticipate that very few people will obtain relief under this one for post-conviction petitioners. As Ms. Christian noted, from our standpoint, actually, to have this sort of escape valve will make it we want this, the Department of Justice wants this, not only to be fair to petitioners, but also it will cut down on our work because we need to, because when this thing happens, we have to litigate whether the person is entitled to any sort of relief, and as she alluded to, we may have problems ultimately in the federal courts on this issue. And so from our standpoint, to allow this escape clause for the very few people who actually would benefit from it is going to cut down on litigation and save everybody a lot of time and money. And another point that Ms. Christian made that I think I should emphasize, and that is that a couple of times over the past several years we have had this situation come up through no fault of the petitioner's counsel or through no fault of the petitioner, but because a trial court clerk neglected to send out the notice of entry of judgment to the petitioner's counsel. And the case law that is developed in the appellate courts is that the mere fact that you were not served with a notice of entry of judgment as required by the statute is not a legitimate excuse for filing an untimely notice of appeal, and usually, because notice of appeal is a jurisdictional issue, and so we had some petitioners who were defaulted on filing a notice of appeal through no fault of their own, but due to the fault of county clerks.
Okay.
So this would allow for relief in those circumstances.
Thank you. Are your questions answered, Senator Barr?
They're answered.
Okay. Do I have to wait for Senator Walker to come get this out of our committee?
That depends what Senator Cruz and Senator Brzezinski want to do with it.
I'm sorry. I do have a question, just because I'm a new kid. What's a colorable claim of error? Seems like a strange term.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, it is a strange term. It's a legal term, and actually there is some recent case law out of the Oregon Supreme Court on what constitutes a colorable claim. And it is, if I could say it this way, it is one that is not frivolous, that there is some potential merit to. You don't have to establish that you, in fact, will prevail on it, but that it is a claim that potentially does have merit based on the facts and the law, that it is not completely frivolous. And so that also serves as a limitation on people obtaining relief, because they have to establish, they will have to convince the appellate court not only that it was not their fault for filing for defaulting in the filing of a notice of appeal, but also that they actually do have a legitimate, potentially meritorious claim that they're going to assert on direct appeal. And we sometimes, in the context of direct appeal in a criminal case, we sometimes are able to get such a motion for filing an untimely notice of appeal. We're often able to get such a motion denied on the ground that they can't show a colorable claim of error.
Okay.
I guess colorable deals with the gray area.
Very well put, Senator Cruz.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill and ask Senator Cruz if he is comfortable with this bill.
Not entirely, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll wait. All right. Now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2300. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2300 relates to the issuance of concealed handgun licenses and responds to a case, Bates versus Gordon. ORS 166.291 through ORS 166.293 discuss concealed handgun licenses, or CHLs. ORS 166.291 and .292 establish procedures to obtain and to issue licenses. ORS 166.293 relates to the denial and revocation of licenses. Subsection 2 of 293 establishes one ground for denying a license as, in sum, any time the sheriff has reasonable grounds to believe that the applicant is a danger to himself or others as demonstrated by the applicant's past pattern of behavior. Subsection 3A of ORS 166-293 then discusses grounds for revoking rather than denying a license. Prior to 2003, this section, subsection 3A, stated that a license could be revoked for any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a license under ORS 166.291 to ORS 166.293. Some felt that this language was inaccurate, because technically licenses are only issued under 166.291 and 292, not under 293. So, in part, due to this concern, in 2003, the legislature amended ORS 166.293, subsection 3A, to read, any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a license under ORS 166.291 and 166.292 is cause for revoking a concealed handgun license. The Oregon Court of Appeals found this change problematic originally. In Bates v. Gordon, 201 Oregon Appellate Court 619, a 2005 case, the court held that the 2003 amendment effectively invalidated subsection 2 of 166.293 as a grounds for revoking a license. On September 26, 2006, the Oregon Supreme Court vacated the Court of Appeals opinion in Bates and remanded the matter back to the Court of Appeals for reconsideration. That was done by 341 OR 449 in 2006. On May the 2nd of this year, the Oregon Court of Appeals issued its revised remanded opinion in Bates versus Gordon and essentially found that it was wrong originally. Regardless, what House Bill 2300 does is it addresses the problem by amending ORS 166.293-3A to clarify that any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a concealed handgun license is cause for revoking a concealed handgun license. The key thing that the amendment does is it takes out any reference to the other statutes whatsoever.
Okay, we have Mr. Powell in the audience here. Council did a pretty good job of wrapping up the court thing, but just if you could just summarize what got us here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The staff has, as you point out, very clearly delineated the judicial side of the equation. The amendment that was made last session to the law, if you will look on line 16 of the printed bill and the sections that are being deleted, prior to this change in the law in 05, that actually said under ORS 166.291 and 166.293, 293. And that included the revocation part that would allow revocation for somebody that could be a danger to themselves or others. With this change in the law, and what brought up the legal case was that no longer was cited here, and so you could not revoke the license for the same reasons that you could deny a license. What this bill does is very clearly allow revocation for the same reasons that you would deny in the first place. So it's just a common sense amendment that straightens that out.
And committee, just to remind you that this change was made, deleting that 166.293, the change was made in the Scribner's bill, which specifically states that all the changes therein are non-substantive, and yet the Court of Appeals considered this a substantive change. So the Supreme Court straightened it out, but we can be absolutely clear for future generations of legislators and sheriffs if we pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Byer.
It was 03 Scribner's bill, I believe, not 05.
Okay. And that well could be. I have never read a Scribner's bill in its entirety.
And but, John, will you agree that with this most recent court case of just last week that this bill and in any form is moot? It means the same thing either if we pass the bill or do not?
Mr. Chair Senator Byer, I agree that is the status of the law today. However, since a fairly distinguished panel of jurists decided otherwise once, we think it's wise to clarify the law.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to testify on this? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, close the hearing on House Bill 2300. Open a work session on House Bill 2300. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2300 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved the House Bill 2300 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. To avoid panic, would you like to carry it?
No.
Okay. Senator Pruzanski, I'll ask you to carry this.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yes, and now I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2133. Senator Pruszynski.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pruszynski has moved House Bill 2133 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Madam Chair, the objection. I guess you asked to call the roll or just to record at least my objection to the bill. And, you know, after the bill we saw last week where we're going to extend this while they're in federal court, is there ever going to be an end to post-conviction release?
One of those Shakespearean questions. Call the roll, please.
No.
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Mr. Byer?
No.
Aye. Okay. I'll carry that bill. All right. Now we will open a public hearing on, let's see who we've got close to sign up here. On House Bill 2138, Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2138 relates to the pretrial release of certain defendants and reconciling statutory provisions with Oregon constitutional provisions. Article 1, Section 43.1b of the Oregon Constitution requires courts to base pretrial release decisions on the, quote, reasonable protection of the victim and the public, close quote, in addition to the likelihood that the defendant will appear for trial. In relevant part, the Constitution states there should be no bail for violent felonies if the court determines that, one, there is probable cause that the defendant committed the crime, and, two, there is clear and convincing evidence that releasing the defendant presents a danger to the victim or the public. That's what the Constitution says. ORS 135.240 also addresses the pretrial release of defendants in statutory form. Presently, its provisions appear to conflict with the Oregon Constitution in at least two ways. The Constitution addresses release for any, quote, violent felony, close quote, but the statute applies only to 19 specific felonies and does not include felonies such as third-degree assault, third-degree rape, assaulting a public safety officer, intimidation, or encouraging sexual abuse of a child. Also, the Constitution establishes a narrower standard of review for a court to decide to release a defendant. The constitutional standard is whether the defendant poses a danger of physical injury or sexual victimization to the public. The statute has a broader standard, whether the defendant will commit any new criminal offenses. House Bill 2138 attempts to reconcile the statutes with the Constitution. It adopts the constitutional phrase violent felony, which it defines as a felony involving, quote, actual or threatened serious physical injury to the victim or a felony sexual offense, close quote. Under House Bill 2138, the court should deny pretrial release of a defendant charged with a violent felony if, one, there is probable cause to believe that the defendant committed the crime, and two, there's clear and convincing evidence that if released, the defendant poses a danger of physical injury or sexual victimization to the victim or to the public.
Okie dokie, Mr. Sylvester is back. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I think it is fair
can
to
you
say.
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice, Appellate Division, testifying on support of 2138. I also want to pass on that the Oregon District Attorneys Association also supports this bill. This bill, I think, fairly can be characterized simply as housekeeping. We drafted it up for the sole purpose of ensuring that Article 1, Section 43, which was enacted in 1999 as part of the Victims' Rights Bill, is essentially codified into ORS 135-240, the statutes that govern pretrial release. It is not our intention to have the statute say anything different from what the Constitution provides, and so in that respect, I think it's merely housekeeping. Committee counsel, I think, fairly described what the bill does, and my written testimony does, too. Unless the members of the committee have additional questions for me, I think I will just stand with that.
Okay. What took you so long?
Amen.
In the sense that this has been sitting around since 1999 and not being corrected? That is a good question, Chair Burdick. It should have been done many years ago, and it's just one of those things I think that fell through cracks and hasn't been fixed. One of the problems was is that, as my written testimony explains, this is kind of a problem that's created by Ballot Measure 40, which was originally a constitutional provision that restricted pretrial release for certain types of offenders, and that particular ballot measure 40 was codified into 135-240, and then shortly after that, of course, the Oregon Supreme Court struck down ballot measure 40, and the pretrial release provision therefore became a dead letter as a result of that. And then that part of ballot measure 40 was resubmitted to the voters in 1999, and the voters in fact did approve it.
We're aware of all that. You still didn't answer the question.
And I think the problem is that, Senator Burdick, is that people were not aware that there was a slight change in what was in the original ballot measure 40 and what was done in Article 1, Section 43, the current one. There is, as committee counsel noted, there are a couple of minor differences in the way that the provisions were phrased, and so that is the reason why it's
okay.
Necessary to do that.
Okay.
But
any question? Senator Barr.
Thank you. You may not be able to answer this question, but maybe counsel does. Does legislative counsel agree with your opinion that the statute and the Constitution is in conflict? And I ask the question because having served on legislative counsel committee, they go through what I would say with painstakingly detail to make sure that there aren't conflicts between both administrative rules and statute, but also statute and Constitution. And I find it amazing that this has been missed for 10 years or 8 years now. And again, I guess back to your question, how could this have been gone on this long? And all three of us were in the legislature in 97 and 99, so we participated in this.
And from time immemorial, it feels like sometimes.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I'm not sure I'm the one. I'm not sure if there's a question in that for me, but we have been very careful in drafting this to make sure that the two provisions now would be identical. And in my particular view of the current statutory provision and the constitutional provision, I think that they are in conflict to the extent that the current statute cannot be enforced. And my understanding is that the courts around the state are not applying the current the statute because everybody views it as out of conflict with the constitutional provision.
Okay, let me stop you right there. You still haven't answered the question, but I'm tired of the discussion. So I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2138. Senator Byers.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2138 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2138 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Madam Chair, just a question. Once again, pleading ignorance. Does this limit the court's ability to deny post-prison release on other factors, for example, risk of flight or something like that? It does not have an impact.
Senator Cruz, this bill solely relates to pretrial release.
I understand.
Yeah, and so it should not have anything like post-conviction stuff. It should not.
Talking pretrial release. It's talking about risk to the defendant or public. But does threat of flight fall into that as a reason for denial?
Senator Cruz, it would, to the extent the constitutional language, the threat of flight, it presents a danger to the victim or to the public.
So
is
broad
the standard.
Enough.
Yeah.
Broad enough to cover that. Okay.
And that's the constitutional standard.
Madam Chair, I take this as actually making the statute less restrictive as to the reasons they can hold a person. Currently the Constitution says you can hold a person for more reasons than the statute says.
Correct.
And this is saying the statute is conforming to the Constitution.
So this broadens out the ways
it gives the court more reason to hold a person, not less.
Okay.
Right.
It also applies to the present constitutional provision applies to any violent felony, but the statute is narrower.
Right. I understand that part.
More conduct.
I was just trying to figure out if risk of flight or evasion would constitute a threat to the public. And okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Sure. Always like to make our laws meet our Constitution.
He'll give it its
that
proper...
Easy for speech.
He'll give it its appropriate treatment, I'm sure, Senator Beyer. I know I can count on you. Okay, last bill of the day. House Bill 2149, public hearing. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2149 is a product of the Underage Drinking Task Force. It expands a court's authority to order alcohol assessment and treatment in certain situations. ORS 471.430, subsection 6, authorizes a court to order alcohol assessment and treatment for persons ages 18 to 20 who violate prohibitions relating to alcohol. The authority is not provided for persons ages 17 and younger. House Bill 2149 expands the statute to allow the court to order alcohol and assessment and treatment for any underage person, not just people 18, 19, and 20. For first-time underage offenders, the court has discretion whether to order the treatment. For repeat underage offenders, the assessment and treatment is mandatory.
Okay, Mr. Schradl.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. This is one of the bills that came out of the Underage Drinking Task Force that was put together at the Attorney General's behest. And this is to cover a circumstance that we think was overlooked, and I think potentially at the time the statute was enacted originally that the problem of underage drinking didn't delve down into quite the teenage problem that we currently see. As the Attorney General Underage Drinking Task Force report shows, drinking rates in Oregon for underage drinkers are higher than the national average, and those reach down into the 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds as well. This would authorize, once somebody has gone all the way into the juvenile court system and been adjudicated as having violated 471-430, which are the minor in possession statutes, that the court would be authorized to order assessment and treatment and would put drinkers who are in the 13, 14, 15, 16-year category the same, treat them the same as those older drinkers 18, 19, and 20. And it simply is an authorization to the court to order the assessment and treatment on the first violation. It wouldn't require that at all. And again, in the Underage Drinking Task Force report, there was a strong encouragement to treat with consistent and uniform practices underage drinking issues, because that has been shown statistically to have the best deterrent effect on underage drinking. And in fact, the Surgeon General's recent call to action that we provided to all the members of the Legislative Assembly note that on the national level as well, the problem of underage drinking is reaching earlier and earlier into teen drinkers. And this is an attempt to try and get them help and treatment at an earlier age. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Looks like a very excellent bill. Any questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you. And I don't know if I'm reading this correctly or not, but I think I am, that this statute has been amended in 01, 99, twice, 91, 79. I think that's what all that means, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you say this is a overlooked section. I have a hard time believing after this many looks at this statute that it's overlooked, so there must have been some reason that the prior legislators wanted it only to be 18 and 20, you know, not under 18. And have you gone back and looked at the history of these?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, no. In fact, the focus and why we bring this to the attention of the legislature now, I think, is because of the focus that the governor and the attorney general had given to underage drinking. When we undertook our task force effort, we reviewed all the statutes that existed and looked for ones that we thought could be improved. I don't know the answer to your question as if it was a conscious choice by some earlier legislative assembly or not. I don't think there is an awful lot of justification for the difference in treatment for the earlier age drinkers.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Please, Senator.
Who's going to pay for this treatment if the court orders it?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the next provision in ORS 471-430 would look in the first instance to the person who the assessment and treatment is being ordered for. And so they are required by statute already to provide what resources they have to pay for the assessment and treatment. It could also well be covered by insurance.
So I guess, Madam Chair, I guess there, to me there is a policy reason, is that you're not talking about juveniles, not adults. And so, in effect, you're probably telling parents they have to pay for it.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I think that's true. And I think that's appropriate in as much as for the earlier age drinkers, that the parental involvement hopefully is higher. The children probably still are within the household, potentially at least, one would hope, living at home. And again, the task force thought one of the best ways of getting at deterring underage drinking is to get parental involvement.
Well, I don't know if I disagree with that statement, but I don't know that this does it by ordering a treatment or a look at it.
This is discretionary, is that correct?
Chair Burdick, in the first instance, for the first violation, yes.
Mm-hmm. We've seen quite a few of these from the underage drinking task force, and
I haven't agreed with all of them either.
We're plowing new ground here, definitely. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you
very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2149. And, Senator Beyer, I catch some certain hesitation on your part about this.
Yeah, I don't know that I like it. I'm going to digest it at least a little bit. If you want to move it today, if you have the three votes, I will think about it further.
I'm going to wait and wait on this, and maybe you could discuss it further with Mr. Schradl or others, and we all can, because that was a good point about when you talk about under 18, the responsibility for payment. Okay, that completes our agenda. Is there any other discussion? We are adjourned.
So I missed the answer to why did you...